broadcasting from the frozen tundra of Texas this hour. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. I'm not actually in Texas, but our guest is in Texas. And I don't know if you heard this, but it's been cold in Texas. We think Texas is a lot of things: big, beautiful, full of oil and cattle. We don't usually think of it as 8 degrees below, but it's been very cold in Texas lately. Trent Horn joining us from Texas. And this hour, it's an atheism hour. If you're an atheist, you're going to the top of the line. We want to talk to some atheists. 888-318-7884. And anyone can call. You're welcome to call, but Answering Atheism is our theme this hour. We take it from the title of Trent's book, Answering Atheism: How to Make the Case for God with Logic and Clarity. Trent Horn, it's very nice to see you again.
It's good. It's good to see you as well, Cy. Though it's interesting how you I think I belong in Texas because the adjectives you use to describe Texas have also been used to describe me on many occasions.
Full of oil and cattle?
And big and beautiful, yeah. Everybody, I feel like everyone says that about me. Big, beautiful, full of oil and cattle.
I doubt this. I don't like to doubt you, Trent, but I doubt that these things have been said about you. I mean, beautiful.
I may be slightly exaggerating. Okay, at least one of them.
888-318-7884, the number. As I said, this is Answering Atheism Hour, and the best thing to do is to get to talk with atheists or maybe doubters or people who are not sure if they're an atheist or a believer or an agnostic. If you're on that end of things, you are our target caller today. But anybody can call if you have a question. Maybe you're a Catholic person and you're like, I've got this atheist, uncle. And my atheist uncle has all these great arguments, and I can't answer him. Well, Trent will help you answer him. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. How did you get in the answering atheism business, Trent?
Well, Answering Atheism was the first book that I published with Catholic Answers. It was a topic that I was interested in because when I was going to university campuses, I would speak on pro-life issues. And when I would engage pro-choice advocates on university campuses, many of them were very critical of religion, and they assumed that we were all a certain kind of Christian, even though our own pro-life group was a diversity of Christians. And at one time, we had an agnostic with us who was pro-life but was not religious. So I got to engage them on the subject and found it fascinating. Then when I started working at Catholic Answers, I felt a calling to write a book on atheism, because I felt like there wasn't really a comprehensive book on atheism written from a Catholic perspective. There were a few shorter books on atheism written by Catholic apologists, really more against Richard Dawkins, but I didn't feel they were comprehensive. I was concerned about the tone of some of them. So I wanted to write something that I felt would strike a nice balance of covering a variety of arguments and also having a charitable tone. So I've been very interested in doing that. I've done several debates with atheists over the years, and it's been really enjoyable. So yeah, and hopefully I'll be doing another debate with an atheist at the beginning of Easter. Matt Dillahunty and I will be debating the resurrection, I believe April 8th, on the Pints with Aquinas channel.
Oh, great. With Matt Frad will be the moderator. Is that how that'll work?
He will.
So this is one of the things I love about your podcast, too, is you're basically willing to talk to anybody. And you've had lots of, Calvinists on who disagree with the sacraments of the church. But you've had a good number of atheists or agnostic folks on. By the way, you can get Trent Horn's podcast by going to trenthornpodcast.com. The podcast is called Council of Trent. trenthornpodcast.com is the place to go. I don't want to put you on the spot or anything, but say all of a sudden a debate broke out between you and Richard Dawkins, the world's most famous atheist. How would you do? Would he mop the floor with you? Could you handle that kind of pressure? Or how would it go?
Well, I would enjoy being able to debate Richard Dawkins, because Richard Dawkins has routinely declined to debate Christian apologists, saying it would be good for their resumes, but not for his.
Oh, well, he might.
So I'd feel excited I actually get the chance to debate him. Though what's fascinating is he has said, I won't debate apologists, but I'll debate the Pope, I'll debate bishops. And there's been a standing offer from Word on Fire by Bishop Barron to debate Richard Dawkins, and he hasn't taken it up, even though in the past he said he wouldn't debate apologists, but he would debate a bishop of the Catholic Church. So I've always found that to be interesting.
Well, and Bishop Barron is a bishop of the Catholic Church, as you can tell from his first name, Bishop Barron. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. Do you ever have that concern that, for example, when you, on the Trent Horn podcast, you have, say, an atheist person, do you ever have the concern that Dawkins says he has about you that, well, I'm giving this person a prominence, but I profoundly disagree with their message against God. Does it ever give you pause?
No. When I choose people to dialogue with or to engage in formal debates, I do have a certain set of criteria. I think that they should have some sort of prominence. You know, they shouldn't just be a random person, because if the debate goes well, then all people are going to say is, well, yeah, you just debated a nobody who doesn't know what they're talking about. But if someone has established a platform for themselves and are known in the atheist community and held to at least some kind of esteem, then I think it's worthwhile to publicly engage them on the subject.
Fair enough. All right, well, we've got some atheists who would like to engage with you. Shall we go to the phones?
Sure.
All right, Trent Horn, apologist extraordinaire, author, and now Texan, is our guest. 888-318-7884 is our number. Let's go to San Francisco, where Damien is watching on YouTube. Well, let me make sure. Hang on, Damien. I got to make sure I got the right number for the line here. Sorry, Damien, to keep you waiting. Go ahead with your question for Trent Horn, or your comment, or want to share with us why you're an atheist. Whatever. It's a free-for-all. Go ahead.
Hi, Trent. Welcome to Texas. I'm out here in San Francisco getting away from the cold weather for a little bit.
You and Ted.
And, welcome to the Lone Star State.
So, it's fun. It's good to be here.
Sure. But yeah, it's pretty much, I'm an atheist because that's the default position we're born to. And I just have yet to be convinced out of that as of yet. So that's really all it is. Being an atheist doesn't necessarily make you an anti-theist. You can also be religious and anti-religious and an anti-theist as well. Atheism has nothing to do with pushing back against religious dogma or the ultra-conservative.
Well, Damien, let me jump in. I'd like to jump in real fast. What does the word atheism mean to you?
Nothing. It doesn't mean anything to me because the ism part of it implies some sort of unified worldview around that lack of belief in a deity. Atheists come in all stripes and colors for all kinds of worldviews. They're just unified.
Okay, let me rephrase the question. What does it mean that you are an atheist?
It just means that I've yet to become convinced that the supernatural is part of reality, other than just an imaginative idea in someone's head.
Okay. Damien, do you think there's a difference between, let's say, like, I have a two-month-old at home. He has yet to become convinced there's a supernatural reality. And you have yet to become convinced there's a supernatural reality. Are you both equally atheists, or is your atheism different?
We both started off at the same position. It's just that your child there he's an implicit atheist because he hasn't actually had time to address the question of the idea that's been presented to him yet. Okay. I'm an explicit atheist because I started off that way, but then people were presenting their arguments to me and I still didn't find them convincing yet.
Okay. What argument of all of them would you say is the least problematic of the arguments? Because I think arguments for any position are going to be better or worse. For example, I think the problem of evil is a stronger argument for atheism than just saying that we should be atheists because Santa Claus doesn't exist either. So I think there can be weaker and stronger arguments for being an atheist. You said arguments have been presented to you, you don't find convincing. What would you say is the strongest, or another way I could put it is the least problematic, if you had to rank them? Like, what is the best case that's been put to you, and what was wrong with it?
None of them. They're all kind of equal to me. They all kind of fall. It's like asking me which one of the Harry Potter novels is most likely to be true. And I'm going, they're all kind of equally untrue, regardless of the arguments. Because for me, what you were presenting, like,
so you think that all, that's just really fascinating to me. You think that the arguments for God are all equally unconvincing. So like one argument would be God exists because many people throughout history have believed in God. And another argument would be that things that don't have to exist require an explanation in a necessary being, and we have reasons to believe that necessary being is God. Wouldn't you say philosophical arguments for God are stronger than just saying many people have believed in God?
No. So back to what you just presented there, you said a necessary being. Already you're smuggling in the concept that it needs to be a being that was the start of something. So you're already a priori giving your presupposition there that it needs to be a being even to begin with. Because any concept that you're attributing to the attribute to this deity, you can also equally attribute it to an unknown natural thing.
So what's the difference between a thing and a being?
A being is a subset of a thing. So it
what
could
is
be
a thing?
Being, it could be just a natural event or something like that.
Well, what is a thing?
Okay. What are you trying to get here? Could you be more explicit on what you're trying to understand?
Well, what you were saying was that if there is an argument that leads to a certain kind of cause, most philosophers say that the contingency argument for God, saying that the universe does not have to exist, it requires an explanation. That explanation has to be something that explains itself. Most philosophers would call that a necessary being. A being is just something that exists, and I would say has causal power. So I would say that you're right, beings are subsets of things. I think, for example, that numbers could be considered a kind of thing, but a number or a shape can't cause anything. But if there is a cause of the universe, it has to be a thing with causal power. That's normally what we associate with being. It could be matter, it could be a force, it could be something else, but it's got to have causal power, wouldn't you say?
Well, yeah, because you just said a circular logical statement there. A cause of something needs to have causal power. That is
right.
The answer within its definition by what you just said. Mm-hmm. So,
okay. All right. Well, we could continue. Unfortunately, we have to go to a break, and we have other callers. But I think Damien, I have spoken to you previously. So, I tell you what. What is one? Well, I guess here's my last question for you to sort things out. In order for me to take atheism seriously, for those people who would be open to changing their minds on the existence of God, what kind of circumstance would it take for your belief in atheism to be falsified? What would that look like? How could that be done?
I don't believe that belief is something you can consciously do. It's a reaction to your interaction with your environment. Like I could be sitting in a chair. I can't not believe that I'm not sitting in a chair based on that amount of evidence that I'm interacting with. So I don't know what it is to interact with the supernatural because I've never interacted with the supernaturals from what I understand. So I don't know what that would be like. But your deity should know this and should be able to present it and is yet to do it.
So it sounds like, Do you have that position for everything else in the world that you don't know what it would take to change your mind? It would just happen. That sounds like your ability to sift out truth is as arbitrary as like an emotion, like falling in love. Do you think that seems kind of an arbitrary epistemology? Don't you think it'd be better to say, well, I could change my mind on atheism if there was a sound logical argument that led to something like the existence of God?
No, because in interacting with the world, someone can say that they have a black friend. Well, I know that friends exist. They are people, and I can extrapolate that probably may be true. That's a mundane statement. But then when someone says, hey, I know this magical distance world over here with this deity has the ultimate power.
Okay, let me try this, Damien. Last, before we go, do you believe that causes exist?
Yes, of course.
So then, could it be possible to extrapolate from the fact that we know causes exist, that there is a cause for everything that is not caused?
Yeah, but again, you can attribute that idea to a unknown natural thing that has that ability, just like you're attributing that to a deity. Any attribute you can give to your deity, you can also give to an unknown natural event.
Well, let's say this. If it's the cause of matter, it can't be made of matter, right?
It would be another unknown natural thing that would involve matter. It would then create matter, just like there's not
well,
a
like,
wall.
Why can't we just say it's an? Why can't we just say it's an unknown thing?
That's what atheists say all the time.
But you're adding the word. We'll have to move on, unfortunately. But you're smuggling in the word natural to show like as if you have some kind of a claim to knowledge about what an ultimate cause would be. Whereas I would say if we reason to an ultimate cause of the universe, we quickly run out of natural explanations if it turns out to be some kind of immaterial entity that has causal power. But you know, that's this topic we could have gone on for hours and hours. But I'm grateful for your call, a repeat call. We've spoken before, and maybe we'll have another fun conversation again. But thanks for calling.
Trent is right. However, we do have to take a break. As a matter of fact, we're a bit late for our break, but we did enjoy the conversation with you, Damien. If you're an atheist and you'd like to talk with us, we'd love to talk about God. If you'd like to talk about, see, I didn't put, there's no word. If you'd like to talk about not believing in God, that would be it. Yeah, that would be it. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Right now, 20 Answers Lent, still available for free in the ebook format at shop.catholic.com.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live. The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Is prayer powerful? St. Alphonsus Liguori put it this way, he who prays will be saved. He who does not pray, well, you get the point. Prayer can bring us salvation. It's the means of putting us into communion with God, and God can do all things. The more our will lines up with the will of God, the more powerful our prayers, and the simpler they become ultimately, be it done to me, Lord, according to thy word. That's the prayer God will always answer.
Our number, if you're an atheist, perfect hour for you. Anybody can call. We're talking about answering atheism, but it's a perfect hour for an atheist because we'll make you go right to the top of the line and to the front of the line, however you do your line. We do ours up and down, but you can do front of the line. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884, and we don't hide the fact that we believe in God, and we believe a lot of stuff about God as well, but we love to talk with folks who don't and enter into those kinds of conversations. If you like that and you'd like to, you're welcome here, and we promise to be nice. 888-318-7884. We'll go to Maryland now, watching on YouTube Live. Josh in Maryland, go ahead with your question or comment for Trent Horn.
Hi, Trent. How you doing? I'm a convert from Reformed theology. I'm Catholic. Mm. And there is a common apologetic method called presuppositional apologetics. I'm curious what you think about it, and could a Catholic use this method? I think the method is actually very flawed and circular myself, and I didn't even like it when I was a Calvinist. But I'm curious what you think about it.
Yeah. So presuppositional apologetics is the idea that in order to make the case that God exists, one must presuppose God's existence in order to make any kind of rational discourse possible. So the idea here is that logic and rational thinking, they would not be possible if we didn't presuppose the existence of God first. This is also called the transcendental argument for the existence of God. And I have noticed these kinds of presuppositional arguments tend to be most popular among Reformed Protestants or Calvinists. And I think that I don't know exactly why that is, but I suspect it may have something to do with most Calvinists I know would say that that everyone has a knowledge of God. And Josh, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I feel like a lot of Reformed people would say everybody knows God exists, whether they like it or not. If they're an atheist, they're just deep down suppressing their knowledge of God. So we don't really have to prove God exists. Rather, God has made his existence known. It's just obvious. And we have to preach that to people. And the way to make it obvious is to say, look, we couldn't even talk about God rationally if God did not exist. So I don't know if I'm describing a lot of Reformed thinking on the issue right. Would you agree with that?
Mostly. There's one, the main motive, the main reason why it's mostly Calvinist is because a Calvinist invented it, Cornelius Van Til. And
yes,
yeah. and Calvinists right. tend to stick in their like echo chambers, so they don't really get out a lot, so their ideas stay in more in the community a lot more. So that's why it's
Josh, crazy. they can't help it, Josh, because they've been predestined to stay in their echo chamber. I'm sorry.
That's a Calvinist joke.
Thankfully.
Right, yes. Yes, the Calvinists would say that if you were predestined to double predestined to damnation, maybe in being Catholic. What I would say, Josh, there's two separate issues between whether can a Catholic use presuppositional apologetics and should they use it. There is nothing in the Church's teaching that says one cannot presuppose the existence of God to make a logical argument for the existence of God. The Church makes clear in the First Vatican Council that God's existence can be known by reason, but the Church does not endorse a particular argument for the existence of God. It just says we can know God exists by reason, and so some people may use reason and use a presuppositional approach. I know of one popular Catholic book on atheism that does use a presuppositional apologetic approach. So I'd say they can do it. Should they do it? That is a prudential judgment. And I would say I'm not, like you, Josh, I'm not a big fan of presuppositional apologetics for two reasons. One, I believe the method is logically flawed. I believe that no matter how you try to cut it, you end up committing the logical fallacy of begging the question, that you presuppose what you're trying to prove. Now, the presuppositionalist will say, well, look, Trent, at the end of the day, you have to presuppose something. So, you know, I presuppose, you know, everybody, you can't have an argument with infinite premises. There has to be something that is true just because it's self-evident that it's true. And I would agree with them, but I would say that they've jumped the gun a little bit in saying that self-evident thing is God. I think the only way you can get to God, as St. Thomas Aquinas said, is to reason from the world around us. Since we don't know what God is like, we can only look at the world around us and reason back to a cause and then figure out God's attributes. So I would say logically, I don't think it works, especially, Josh, like when I see Protestants preach this. Like I was watching a debate with Douglas. Oh, he's a Protestant gentleman who does this. His name escapes me at the moment, but he's debated Dan Barker. He debated James White, actually, on whether Catholics were Christians. He says that we are. And he did a debate where he basically said you could presuppose not just the existence of God, but the existence of the Christian God. And I just don't see how you can get there. Even if you presuppose that God, there's an infinite act of being that made the world, how can you say that that being is a trinity, that it became incarnate? To me, you need to have evidence for that. You can't just presuppose it. So that's one problem. I don't think it works logically. And two, I would just say I haven't known very many atheists who've been persuaded by this kind of argument. I've known far more atheists who've been persuaded by classical apologetics, cosmological arguments, moral arguments, fine-tuning, things like that, not this kind of stuff. So I guess that would be my answer. Is that a helpful reply?
Yeah, that's pretty much what I was thinking. But there is one issue that I've noticed with presuppositionalism that deals with dogma. Some presuppositionalists do not believe in natural theology. They believe, because they're basically, their idea is they believe in total depravity. They think
dead,
that humans
dead
are
in
so
sin,
depraved.
Right.
Oh, so if you're dead in sin, is that
yes. So that this explains the other reason I think why Calvinists would deny, and this is where we would cut against Reformed theology as Catholics. A Catholic can use presuppositional apologetics as long as they affirm that a person can come through reason to believe in God. That's dogma. Because many Calvinists would say, no, man is so depraved, you know, not that he's as bad as he can be, that's not total depravity, but rather that man has had the image of God so thoroughly erased from him, he can't come to a knowledge of God without the supernatural gift of faith. Unless God reveals it to a man in his own natural state can't even come to know that God exists. So I think that's why they would be against the project of natural theology, And we would reject that. We would say a person through reason can come to know God exists of their own initiative, but they're not able through their own initiative to enter into a relationship of grace and spiritual adoption with God. Nothing we do, the Catechism is very clear, I think it's paragraph 2010 of the Catechism, says that nothing we do merits the initial grace of justification. We cannot do anything. All we can do is accept it through faith, either through our own faith as adults or the faith of our parents when we're baptized as infants. So I would say that that's the problem, that the Catholic could accept this approach. They just cannot reject the school of natural theology.
Thanks very much, Josh. Appreciate that. Answering Atheism is one of Trent's books. Trent Horn is our guest apologist and speaker and author, Trent Horn. If you have a question about atheism, about how to answer atheism, especially if you are an atheist yourself, this hour is for you. 888-318-7884.
Catholic Answers Live. We're here for you.
If you spend any time on Twitter, Facebook, or mainstream media, you're probably familiar with the litany of slogans that skeptics employ to rescue you from the foolish belief that God exists. The constant onslaught seems to leave people with the idea that they have no alternative but to embrace atheism. How can a Christian respond? In One Less God Than You, John DeRosa breaks down 20 of the most common atheist challenges and shows you how to craft effective answers. Atheism is more aggressive and widespread than ever. Read One Less God Than You and prepare yourself to respond with the joyful truth that God is real. To get your copy of One Less God Than You, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
To many people, even many Christians, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the church to make salvation complicated and keep people in fear. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. The Bible supports it, Christians have historically believed in it, and it makes theological sense. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I provide the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a joyful, hopeful reality, not something shadowy and mysterious, but a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It feels so good to be back on Monday and to have Trent here with us. I just feel like in recent months, with you giving birth to a baby at home and then your whole family moving halfway across the country, we just haven't seen enough of you, Trent. It's nice to have you back.
It's good to be back. It was hard. I was looking forward to Monday coming on the show and doing 2 hours. I think it was Why Are You Pro-Choice? And then I woke up on Monday. So Sunday night was the big deep freeze here last Sunday. You know, it's funny, Si, actually on Saturday I was in Houston speaking at the Fullness of Truth conference.
Oh yeah.
And my flight was canceled on Saturday. So it was moved to Sunday, and I knew that was never gonna happen. So I got in the rental car, I called the company, and I got them to let me drop it off in Dallas. So I drove 4 hours on Saturday, got home went to the store, got everything prepped. The snow came, the cold weather. My flight didn't make it back to Dallas until Thursday.
Oh, good call taking the car. Good call.
No, if I had waited till the next day, I would have been stuck in Houston. And then Monday, when I woke up, I was excited for the show. Three of our pipes froze in our master bedroom. And I didn't know if we were going to lose power. And we did everything we could to keep them from freezing. But, I mean, it was like negative 13 here with the wind chill. It was colder than Alaska. It was just the weirdest thing, but I was prepared. I had extra supplies, and we were ready to roll. But it was a very surreal experience, and definitely I would encourage our listeners: one, pray for the people in Texas who are still recovering from burst pipes and other things, And then also do what you can to help. You can donate to like the North Texas Food Bank or other groups here that their supplies have been spread thin because they've been out helping people. Our church, actually, St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, well, we go to St. Basil's for Byzantine, but for daily mass, we often go to St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, and they, all their pipes just burst. The church, the gym, they're still cleaning it up. We found, Cy, that commercial and apartment buildings seem to have been hit the worst when it comes to the pipes. I think it's because their water pipes are under higher pressure. So when they freeze, it's just more likely they're going to explode.
Yeah.
So, yeah, pray, do what you can to materially help those in need here. But honestly, Cy, I love Texas because when everyone was not doing well, everyone got on the phones to do what they could. How can I help you? How can I help? Everybody wanted to pitch in. And it's just the Texas spirit. We actually took in a family of seven the first night that lost power and heat. And lots of people did that. So it's a good place.
That's good. I'm glad to hear it. And that's just what you always hear about Texas. So I'm glad to hear that it's true. Our number is 888-318-7884. It's Answering Atheism this hour. And if you've got an atheism question, you are welcome to call. Let's go to Toronto, Canada. Ayush in Toronto, Canada is on the line. Hang on, Ayush, let me push the right button here. Go ahead with your question or comment for Trent.
Hey, guys. Trent, I'm a big fan of you. So to let you know where I'm at, I'm basically a former atheist at this point, being very convinced by the historical case for the resurrection of Christ.
Okay.
What I'm struggling to understand, though, is the nature of the atonement in Protestant versus Catholic theology. My understanding of Protestant theology is that, you know, we originally had this first covenant, the Mosaic Law, and that, in a sense, almost exposed our sin, our need for a Savior, and then Christ came to save us once and for all. And I understand in Catholic theology there's some element of needing faith and works and justification. And so it almost seems like the atonement, you know, didn't do anything or wasn't completely necessary in that sense. So I'm struggling to understand that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, I will say that we are going to have to oversimplify for the sake of this discussion, because there are different Protestant views of the atonement, and even Catholics articulated in different ways. Though there are some views that are prohibited for Catholics to believe. The view that I know is prohibited for Catholics is to believe that Jesus suffered reprobation. This is what the Catechism says. What that means is God did not punish Jesus on the cross for our sins. So many Protestants will say Jesus took our punishment. And you could say that in a metaphorical way, but it's not the case that God poured out his wrath on an innocent person who took our punishment. A more common view of the atonement would be that God offered a sacrifice of love that made up for the debt our sins incurred. So I think a lot of times, Ayush, when we think about atonement in the West, especially among Protestants, we think about it in kind of more like guilt and innocence, taking away guilt, making someone innocent. But I think the better categories to understand atonement and justification would be debit and credit, and death to life, spiritual death to spiritual life. So the idea would be that in Adam, through Adam's sin, Adam lost the gift of God's grace, could not pass it on to his descendants. So when it comes to original sin does not mean we are born with some kind of evil thing. It means we're born with an absence of God's grace. We don't have the spiritual equipment that is necessary to live with God for all eternity. So how does God remedy this? Well, God, and also not just that, we also sin because of this, and those sins create a debt against God, a debt we cannot pay. When we sin, you know, and the scripture talks about this, think about the Our Father, forgive us our trespasses is in Matthew. In Luke, it says, forgive us our debts, and debts is a Hebrew term that can refer to sins. So when we sin against God, the infinite perfect being, we incur this kind of infinite debt we cannot pay. How does God forgive the debt? Well, he could just snap his fingers and make it go away. He's all powerful. He can do whatever he wants. So while some Protestants argue that the crucifixion was necessary, St. Thomas Aquinas says that it's fitting. It's fitting in that God chose to do something in a graphic, visceral way to show that he would offer a sacrifice of love, that Jesus, the goodness of Christ laying down his life for us, in Christ going from the highest honor in the universe, God, to the lowest honor among men, which is a crucified criminal, in taking all of this on and offering his life. And because he's fully God and fully man, Christ's sacrifice is of infinite worth. So you can think about a scale, like our sins weigh out the scale with God and we can't pay them back. But Jesus's sacrifice is super abundant. It's infinite goodness that it atones, as 1 John 2:2 says, not just for our sins, but for the sins of the whole world. So it makes salvation possible for all. Now, here's the question. How will it be applied? That's the difference, I think, between Catholics and Protestants, especially Calvinists. Many Calvinists will say that the crucifixion, that the salvation was applied to the elect, those who would go to heaven, that Jesus only died for them. And it's done, it's signed, sealed, delivered. So Calvinists would say Jesus died for the elect, not for everyone. We would say Jesus died for everyone. But then here comes the question, why isn't everybody going to go to heaven? How is that grace applied to us? We have to freely accept it. That's the key here. God has given us this gift of grace, and he gives us the freedom to choose, will we accept God's gift of salvation? Will we accept it? And even if we accept it, we might reject it later. Will we come back to be reconciled to him? So it's interesting, in Hebrews 10:26, it says, if we sin deliberately after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins. So it's clear the crucifixion makes our salvation possible, but we could choose to never accept it, or we could choose to accept it and reject it later. So the Catholic view of justification would just be this. We are adopted into God's family, spiritually adopted in baptism. We go from original sin, spiritual death, to spiritual life, and we receive the graces Adam lost. And in receiving those, God gives us other graces to persevere until the end. And so our justification is that we can do nothing to earn that initial salvation, but when we do good works animated by the Holy Spirit, we increase that justification God gave us. We can't earn the light of justification, but by cooperating with God's grace, we can make it brighter. There's a lot we could go through, and I'm going to recommend some books. We will send them to you so that you could grow in this area. But how is that as a start?
Good explanation. Just if I could just kind of come down on one point on how that kind of grace is applied to us. Protestants, more, right. I guess, of the Arminian persuasion would understand that it's applied through like an accepting of Christ in your life, right? And you would say that, I guess, that accepting of Christ in your life also comes with works as well. You can't separate that faith and works. But if our sins have been paid for by the sacrifice on the cross, it doesn't click with me why the works need to flow from that, because you said that we can fall from grace through our sin. So even after someone is baptized into the Catholic Church or has accepted Christ, they still sin. So
correct. But it's for the same logic, Ayush, that even though Christ's sacrifice atones for all sins, the same logic that says that a person who never accepts Christ will not be saved, even though their sins have been atoned for, they have chosen to not allow Christ's sacrifice to be applied to their sins. The same logic that just as a person who never accepts Christ, their sins are not forgiven, even though atonement is universal, it applies in a similar logic to someone who is saved, who becomes Christian, but who later rejects Christ and rejects the covenant. That's also in Hebrews chapter 10, verses 26 and 27. It says a fearful prospect of judgment remains. And it's very clear in verses 28 and 29. It talks about how if you violated the old covenant law, the punishment was death. But if you spurn the Son of God, even though you were sanctified by Christ's blood, how much worse is this going to be? It won't just be natural death. It'll be spiritual death. And I cover this idea about losing salvation a lot more. And I have an interesting exchange with James White about this in my debate with him from several years ago. But I do cover it a lot in my book, The Case for Catholicism. So before we go to a break, I would like to get your email to our call screener. I'll send you The Case for Catholicism, which has two chapters on justification, and my friend Jimmy Akin's book, The Drama of Salvation, which goes over this whole subject in depth. Would that be helpful?
Be awesome. Very much appreciated. Thank you, Trent.
Perfect. So give me the email and we'll get you the books.
Thanks, Ayush. I got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Answering Atheism. If you have questions about how to answer atheist points, or if you yourself are an atheist who would like an answer from us, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Cy Kellett. Catholic Answers Focus is the podcast for living, understanding, and defending your Catholic faith, and you're not going to want to miss it this week. We've got our friend Monica Dumit from Australia to talk about what's happening with confession and how governments are infringing on the right to confession around the world. And we've also got Chris Check, the first part of a three-part series on the Inquisition. CatholicAnswersFocus.com is where you can find us, or find us wherever you get your podcast, Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or just watch us on YouTube, CatholicAnswersFocus.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you want to end abortion, halt the attack on traditional marriage, and ensure religious freedom for ourselves and for our grandchildren? To do this, we must convert the culture. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a grassroots initiative that recognizes this need and takes it to the streets. If you're interested in peacefully sharing the gospel in your area, visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
You remember the time I said on the air, go to confession, and when you're done, go out and have a big ice cream soda. Celebrate. And a man wrote to me, he says, you know, I hadn't gone to confession in 30 years. Do you mind if I went and had a pizza? I said, oh, have 20 pizzas.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Have Trent on every Monday. I like having Trent on a Monday. 888-318-7884. If you're an atheist, let us prove you wrong. 888-318-7884. Let's see. Who are we going to next? Let's go to Neil in San Antonio, Texas, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. Neil, I hope that it has warmed up where you are as well.
It is. It's 76 degrees.
So oh, you're bragging degrees. Now, Neil. You're bragging. Go ahead. What's your question for
thank
Trent?
Thank you so much for taking my call, Trent. I'm a Catholic, and I wanted to ask you, what's your perspective on an interesting take on the problem of evil, which is the problem of animal suffering and kind of evolutionary evil or Darwinian evil, as I've heard it called. Terms of, you know, the animals are innocent creatures and not active moral agents. And so what is the meaning of suffering for them if they don't have access to an afterlife and things like that? I just wanted your take on that.
Right. So this is a variant of the problem of evil. So it's like, hey, there's this evil and suffering in the world. A good God wouldn't allow that. So there is no God. And a Christian would say, well, no. God might have good reasons for allowing evil. And we can think of some right off the bat. Like, well, human beings commit moral evil, but it's good human beings have free will. If you got rid of human beings or got rid of free will, then you'd be out without moral evil, but you'd lose serious goods. I think the problem of animal suffering has become more popular now because a lot of atheists admit they can see the good reasons behind human suffering many times that, well, there are human goods like free will. There's also other human goods. Like even if humans, you know, suffer in a wildfire or a natural disaster. We had a natural disaster here in Texas. It became an opportunity to show compassion to one another and to care for one another. And if we hadn't had that disaster, you wouldn't have had many of these goods. But then an atheist could fire back. Yeah, but Trent, what about some animal in an isolated part of Texas that just froze to death? Where was the good for that animal? They couldn't show compassion or courage. Why would God allow this kind of evil? So how do we respond? Well, I think we have to remind atheists this is their argument. They have the burden of showing God could have no good reasons for allowing animal suffering. And I would say, well, why should, even if I can't think of a good reason, why should I believe that when I can already see God has good reasons for allowing human suffering? And God is infinite. He's omnipotent and all-knowing. I've got no good reason to believe he has no good reasons to allow animal suffering. Who am I to say that he doesn't? Me, a little finite speck in the universe. So that's there's a few different ways I would approach the issue. That's one. Number two, I would say that there are possible reasons, good reasons, God would have for allowing animal suffering. So one of them, just to put a few out there, one would be that it's just part of the physical world. If God makes a world with physical things, then physical things increase and decrease in perfection. A lion isn't really a lion unless it eats a zebra. As the lion gets more perfect, the zebra gets less perfect when it's eaten. So it's kind of the nature of physical things that when something burns, the fire gets better, and the thing it burns, it becomes weaker and poorer and disintegrates. So that's part of the nature of the physical world. A second thing I would say, it's interesting, Neil, when people bring this up, they'll talk about evolution, but I don't think evolution's really the problem. Yes, evolution does make the kind of evil go on for millions of years, but it's not so much that, because throughout for most of the evolutionary process, there was no animal suffering. For most of the evolutionary process, it was like single-celled organisms and fungi and plants. It was only until higher order animals evolved with their higher order capacities for feeling pain. So it's not really evolution. It's why did God allow these certain animals to exist? And one thing that I found interesting, and this came up in my debate with Alex O'Connor, the cosmic skeptic, was I proposed, well, maybe it's just good these animals exist. Now you might say, well, could God make a deer that doesn't feel pain? So the deer doesn't die in a horrible agony in a wildfire. Well, making an animal that doesn't feel pain kind of sounds like a human without free will. How would that animal live if it can't feel pain? It wouldn't know how to run away from danger. It wouldn't be able to function in the natural world. You know, pain is what alerts us to threats. You know, so if an animal didn't have pain, I would say it would just almost be like a puppet that God had made. It wouldn't really be an animal. So is it good for God to make animals? Well, this is a thought experiment, Neil, I offered in the debate with Alex. I said, look, let's say we all went to colonize another planet, like in the movie Interstellar. We solve the problem of gravity. We're getting on our spaceship. And we're about to leave the Earth. There's no more humans on it. What if we could just destroy the Earth and vaporize it instantly? Should we do that? I mean, if we don't, we're going to leave animals on the Earth that will suffer for millions of years. But I think a lot of people are going to hesitate to destroy the Earth for that reason. We see it's still valuable for these animals to exist, even though they do suffer. So I think that gives another clue as to why we can see God has good reasons. So as a long explanation, as the problem of evil does generate, but is that helpful?
It is, yeah. Like you said, you know, I see atheists like cosmic skeptic, you know, acknowledging that human evil, or you know, in terms of the human context, can definitely have much meaning and such, and so that they kind of bring up the animal suffering part of it. But thanks for offering those answers.
Sure.
It's really helpful.
Thanks.
And
Neil,
I would also I'd add two more things to that. One, I also think that the fact that we have such a concern about animals is a problem for atheism. Like, we have a moral duty to show kindness to non-human animals, which from an evolutionary perspective doesn't really make sense if we're only concerned about the survival of our species. So I would say that moral duty we have to be kind to non-human animals, at least to not be cruel to them, I would say that is evidence of a moral lawgiver. And I'd also recommend, there's a lot of books on this subject. I don't necessarily recommend every argument that's in them, but if people want to dive deeper, there is Michael Murray's book, Nature, Red in Tooth and Claw, Thomism and the Problem of Animal Suffering, Animal Suffering, the Problem of Evil by Cregan. And there is another one, All Creatures Great and Small, which has the most unique answer to the problem. The author of that book, All Creatures Great and Small, says that God will just resurrect all the animals at the end of the world, and they'll be compensated with heaven, and they'll become talking Narnia animals. So sometimes in philosophy, you get some kooky things. They're funny.
Do not tell Carlo about that.
So yeah,
those
are the books. Anyone who's
Carlo will not agree.
Oh, has Carlo
with that
talked about? Oh, about the
impossibility of the resurrection of animals.
Well, I'm not going to say it's impossible, Si.
Well, I don't know that he said impossible either. I don't want to speak for Carlo, but
I'm I'm disinclined to think animals will be resurrected, but I'm open to it. God does interesting things you don't always prepared for. So maybe I'll see my dog in heaven. You never know. But my happiness in heaven won't be dependent on my dog.
God does interesting things you're not always prepared for. That's an understatement. Let's get to Kevin in Kentucky watching on YouTube Live. Yeah, Kevin, sure. Glad to have you. Go ahead with your question or comment for Trent Horn. Kevin?
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Oh, happy to, Kevin. Go ahead.
So I'm an atheist, and my question has to do with teleology. I'm an atheist not because I don't accept teleology, but my non-acceptance of teleology is at least one reason why I'm not Catholic.
Before we continue, Kevin, could you just explain to our listeners what you mean by teleology?
Yeah, so...
Hello?
Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead. You dropped for a second. Go ahead, Kevin.
So teleology, at least Thomas Aquinas's teleology, is kind of like a study of purposes or ends. Thomas Aquinas's argument is that because things have ends or purposes, we can argue naturalistically that there's a God. My question has to do with teleology. I guess I don't disagree that some things have some purposes or some ends, but where I disagree is that those things are inherent. So teleoi is just the Greek word for an end or a purpose. I accept that some things have purposes, but I would just argue that those teleoi are imbued by thinking agents like me and you. There's nothing inherent about teleoi. My understanding is that church says that teleoi.
Okay, Kevin. Let me try to break it down for our listeners. I guess I have a few thoughts here. Number one, I like that you branched here because you could certainly believe in God and have a dim view of Thomistic teleology. There's a lot of different theologies out there when it comes to belief in God. Even if you were Catholic, you could have a differing view about the nature of teleology and things like natural law arguments. In the Catholic moral tradition, for example, there is a difference between Thomas's natural law arguments that are more based on the physical teleology and things like the human body, and things like the new natural law arguments put forward by people like Germain Grisez, John Finnis, Robert George, which talk about teleology, but in more of an abstract sense of basic goods, like the end of friendship, the ends of justice, things that we can't undo. So I would say don't let that your concern with that wash over the whole thing. Number two, I would say sometimes like teleology, like we talk about purposes or ends, it can get muddy. And I don't find Aquinas's fifth way to be as powerful as like the first way. Even Thomas would say his argument from motion is more powerful than his argument from teleology. But I would say, Kevin, I disagree with the idea that we just impose ends out on the world. Because it seems to me the goal of science is to discover relationships between matter and energy that seem to be very predictable. And we talk about laws of nature, but the law doesn't really command things. It just describes an interesting predictability in the universe. That, I think, does leave a clue to something interesting about the universe, that it has these natural built-in ends we don't impose, but we discover. I don't know. What do you think about that?
I think that when you said that, you know, laws are not descriptive, they're not prescriptive, they're descriptive, I think you hit the nail on the head. I don't think that really has a whole lot to do with teleology as much as it just has to do with science. And then my comment with regard to science, I suppose, is that science only has an end.
I'm sorry, Kevin, that was the music. I wanted to talk to you more. I'm very sorry.
We can only,
give us your email, we'll send you a few things, call back.
Yeah, you're going to have to go. As a matter of fact, Trent will be on tomorrow. You can call and talk with Trent because, you know, you're a late atheist. I'll take some of the blame, Kevin, but you're a late atheist. You waited until the last 5 minutes to call and ask about teleology. And obviously we need more than 5 minutes to talk about that. So maybe we get to talk with you tomorrow. The number will be the same, 888-318-7884. And it'll be open. open forum. Trent Horn will be here. Tom Nash will be here. It's going to be a great time. I hope we'll see you there, Kevin. I hope we'll see everybody there. Trent, it's great to have you on again. Thanks for being here.
Good to be here, Si.
See you tomorrow, God willing, right here, Catholic Answers Live.